This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be looking at Germany's political nightmare, speaking to one of the world's most eminent psychologists and getting excited by the Winter Olympics. First up, since last year's election, Angela Merkel's chancellorship has seemed to be on thin ice. Her party, the Christian Democrats, have a coalition offer pending with the SPD, which would, at best, see the far-right AfD become the main opposition. What is fueling this unrest, and how long can Merkel continue in the current climate? Thomas Kielinger writes on the future of Germany's leadership in the magazine, and he joins me now along with Anne McElvoy, head of Economist Radio. So Thomas, this week Der Spiegel ran a cover adorned simply with Krise, the German word for crisis. So has the situation in Germany, which has been brewing since the election in September of last year, finally spilled over into a crisis?
Well, the trouble when the Spiegel produced his latest number, it was a moment when things were beginning to move into a better way in Berlin. That is to say that Angela Merkel and her top echelon agreed on a new party general secretary. And the new party general at this point in time looks like she might become the future leader before the next general election. Her name is Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer or whatever. I like the acronym that they've chosen for him, AKK they call her. And that is in a remarkable about-turn for Merkel, to nominate someone who is likely to be her successor. It is important that she does that, because she's refused so far to acknowledge anyone. All her rivals were nipped in the bud in her time in office, just like under Kohl in 18 years. So the Spiegel may be already sort of obsolete by the time we reach next week, when the party will agree on this candidate, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, the General Secretary. So there's hope yet.
And do you think Merkel has got herself into a mess? She seems to be switching between the thing that she says she's definitely not going to do and ending up doing the thing she then doesn't want to do.
Well, the main thing Angela Merkel wants to do is stay being Chancellor. And any deal that comes out with Angela Merkel being Chancellor is, to Merkel's mind, a good one. I mean, I've been sort of spending quite a lot of time around the Chancellor's office recently, and I think they're pretty open internally that this is the late phase of Merkel. The question is it a good late phase or a bad late phase? She's very pragmatic. She even jokes about, you know, people saying she's past her zenith. She says, well, I've been here 12 years, you know, it would be very odd if I were here for 24. So I think she is quite realistic. I think on the Krise point, the crisis, yes, it's true, Thomas, that, you know, something is being pulled together. But when we look at the fact that she's now reliant on the SPD, and not just on that, on the grassroots of the SPD and new members, and we know how that can go, from the Labour Party, it is a difficult situation for such a powerful woman in German politics to end up depending on the foot soldiers of a very weak opposition party. So to that extent, I think the word crisis, it's a slow-burning crisis, but it still exists.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's a crisis of government because we don't have a stable government in power yet. We're weak and stable, as it were, at the moment, depending on coalition partners. And the result of the election was atrocious for the Conservatives, for Angela Merkel's party, only 33%, which is the worst result. And so the search for a coalition is agonising and tortuous. And nobody knows what happens if the members or the SPD reject the proposal on the table.
Do you think they will, Thomas?
They might. It's 177 long document. It's ridiculously long.
Are you suggesting they might read it? Because I'm not sure that happens in British politics.
They might not read it, but it produces a sort of chasm amongst their ranks, and there's that very strong union-oriented sort of wing in the SPD. They will probably support it. But then there's also the educational, intellectual sort of element of it, who reject going into cahoots with Angela Merkel any more time. They want to revive the chances of their party in opposition.
They wouldn't get their way, would they? Because there would be new elections. And this is the Team Merkel sort of proposition, that if you don't go ahead with this sort of elephant coalition, it's a difficult one. No one really wants it. And as the rather good piece in The Spectator says this week, it may not be the answer to Germany's slow-burning crisis about what kind of government it really wants and keep the AfD and the far right out. But at the same time, if you go into new elections with the SPD this week, it's more likely that the far right will gain.
It's not a foregone conclusion that there will be a new election if the SPD rejects this current proposal. In fact, the CDU are hoping, if the decline of the SPD continues in the polls, they might eventually land with a conservative-green coalition that the two parties combined together, while they are not over 50%, might still be the majority combination over all other parties.
And Thomas, do you agree with the cover piece's argument that it's Merkel's policy and style of leadership that has paralysed the country's politics and threatens to see the far right become the main opposition?
Well, she is a sort of cautious, steady-as-it-goes sort of woman who likes to keep her options hidden from everyone until the last moment when something has to give. Although, funnily enough, when one remembers her years in office, she can be quite quick, like a lightning streak, the way she moved Germany off the atomic energy sort of question. It was done without consultation. And the same with opening the border for 1 million asylum seekers or migrants. I look at Merkel now that she has potential successor in view, getting to be more accommodating with the rest of her party and getting on with the job. Except one thing which is unanswered, who is she going to govern with? That will depend very much of how she herself will behave in office.
I think the piece in The Spectator is written from the very firm belief that it was a mistake in 2015 to let in 1 million migrants. What I like less about that analysis is it's not clear what the alternative really would have been from Germany's perspective. I think in many ways Angela Merkel mishandled the tone. She sounded like it was an easier task of integration, as the piece points out, than it's turned out to be. But actually it's also not clear that it's a disaster. I mean, it's not clear that having these people in Germany is in and of itself a disaster, and I think it is oversold to that extent.
But is it a social disaster in terms of tensions? Economically, it may be beneficial.
Can I just answer that? But you know, if you go around Germany, I don't think you know, you're not seeing social tension on the street about it. You're seeing worries about rising crime, which is perceived as linked to it, rightly or wrongly, but it is. You're seeing a sense that, you know, the people were not consulted, and that Merkel's tone and political handling of it, you know, she made it sound like she never revisits the issue and says, like, here's really what I want to do about integration in any deep way, because she knows that divides people. So I think you're right about that, Isabel. But I suppose what I doubt a bit was that there was a sort of very easy road to take in 2015, other than Germany would have then been slammed if there'd been yet more bodies floating around in the Mediterranean. It is stepping up to this role, I think, in Europe as a humanitarian superpower, as a, you know, someone once said of it. I think that has been a sort of difficult burden for Merkel to take forward. But I'm not convinced that it was morally the wrong decision.
Thomas. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because in 2015, there were already those refugees that she opened the doors for were already on EU ground, as it were, and lots of them in Germany. So what do you do if you refuse them? You kick them back into the sea, or goodness knows which country they came from. Some of them didn't have documents left on them. So she did almost a rational thing by trying to kind of avoid a crisis by admitting this amount of people. Now, what she didn't realise is that there is a problem on the social level in Germany. It may not be a sort of vastly apparent sort of crisis point, but there are individual communities in my country who find it very hard to integrate these arrivals, because we're not a multicultural sense in the same Britain is. We haven't really had enough experience to coexist with new sort of colours and creeds. And particularly in education, it's a problem, because there's so many multicultural kids now in classes where the standard of education is being lowered in order to accommodate new arrivals.
That's a fair point.
It is a festering problem. But I think the way that I understand my own country, they like to rise to the occasion, and they like to prove the critics wrong, to say that we will find a way to get to grips with it. And I think I agree with Anne, in the end they will. But there'll be a hard sort of a period now for the next few months to go through.
So Anne, you don't think that we're seeing the decline of Germany?
I don't think we're seeing the decline. I mean, certainly not economically. I mean, Germany has always managed to, you know, offset any predictions that it was the sick man of Europe. You know, economically, it's very strong. Educationally, despite the problem, which I think Thomas quite rightly, you know, points out about newcomers, how strongly can Germany insist that, you know, that they integrate, learn the German language? These are things the society is not particularly used to. You're right. But from having a fairly sort of patchy education system, it has, in the spirit, you know, Thomas mentions, put its shoulder to the wheel, moved itself up PISA, quite impressed with the PISA studies, on educational outcomes in a way that, in some ways, you know, enviable from the UK point of view. I think it needs a change of leadership. And I think this is going to be the problem. When does Angela Merkel say enough is enough? How does she manage transition after 12 years? She can't be like Bismarck. She can't just stay on and on and on. Mm. She knows this. The blessing of Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, AKK, this week shows that she is trying to nominate. But again, you know, is it really the job of the outgoing chancellor to say who comes after her? Yeah. I think there will be something of a feeling in Germany that they'd quite like to choose their next chancellor, not Angela Merkel.
I also like to introduce the question of whether she's going to be weak or strong, the economic issue. As long as Germany produces the goods in the economic field, and if she continues to be such a juggernaut of exact success, she will be blessed with a strong economy, and therefore, in a sense, it'll rub off on Germany's position in the world, never mind whether she's perceived in her own party as weak or strong. The German economy is strong. You can't overlook it, and it really calls the shots. So that is an important issue. That helps her sustaining herself, but it's quite right. How long she will last and when she will say, you know, I'll hand over, we don't know. It's not solid.
I'd say 2 years. What's your
2 years. Yeah, before the election, 2021. 2020 is about the time when
but
we
it,
might
it
see...
But it could move sooner. I think that could it's move sooner, a slightly slippery landscape, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you, Thomas and Anne.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Next, are things really as bad as they seem? No, says the cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker, who chronicles a world getting, by and large, better in his new book, Enlightenment Now. He sat down to discuss this with our literary editor, Sam Leith.
The basic thesis of your book, as I understand it, is that the world has been getting better in almost every respect for a long time and ideally will continue to?
Well, we'll continue to the extent that we identify and continue the forces that made it happen in the past. I think that there has been progress measured in anything that you can measure, such as longevity, education, prosperity, freedom. But it doesn't happen by magic. There isn't any mystical arc of justice or dialectic that just carries us ever upward. It's a result of what I identify as the ideals of the Enlightenment, namely that we apply reason to understanding our situation rather than dogma and authority, that we appeal to science for our best understanding of reality by formulating explanations and testing them, and humanism, that we elevate human well-being as the ultimate moral goal as opposed to the glory of the race or the nation or spreading the faith. So to the extent that the Enlightenment ideals continue to be implemented in institutions, in norms, in values, then progress could continue, but it won't automatically.
So why is it then, if your data sets, and there are a lot of them in this book, there's a huge number of graphs and charts showing how all these things have improved, why is it that your argument seems to come as such a surprise to people? Why is it so fiercely resisted in lots of corners? People saying, you know, well, we've got suicide bombers, we've got the rise of autocracies, we've got, you know, this and that, the rest. Why is it that we aren't prepared to see it?
Well, certainly there is a feature of human cognition in which our subjective estimates of probability and risk are driven by available memories, called the availability heuristic, identified by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. So if there are violent episodes and images that are quickly available, and that's what news serves us, then we'll have the impression that the world is a dangerous place as long as the number of violent incidents don't go to zero, and they're not at zero. People, though, often forget that to talk about any trend, you can't just look at one point, like the present. So if I say, well, the rate of wars has gone down, people say, well, what about Syria? And I said, well, yeah, the rate of wars has gone down. It's not the same as the claim that the rate of wars is zero. To show that the rate of anything has gone up or down, you have to at least compare two different points in time. But there is a kind of historical amnesia to a lot of journalism and punditry and commentary, where an event taking place now is considered emblematic of a trend, even though that just violates the logic of arithmetic. You need to look at the past as well as the present. So I spend a lot of time in the book just documenting that, the past was pretty bad too. In fact, the past was even worse.
Why is it, do you think, that the way we consume news, you know, obviously news cycles are fast and they have this availability heuristic kind of built into them. Why is it that effectively you can kind of monetize that inability to follow the basic logic of arithmetic.
Yeah, there is another quirk of human psychology called the negativity bias, that our attention is much more grabbed by negative events than positive ones. Presumably because there are just so many more things that can go wrong than can go right, and the things that go wrong can do you a lot more harm than the things can go right can help you. And so we have a natural vigilance for disasters. That opens up a niche for professional curmudgeons and doomsayers to remind us of bad things that we may have overlooked.
Is that an adaptive?
Well, it's
kind of bias.
It probably is adaptive just because of such an inescapable feature of the universe that there are more things that can go wrong than can go right, so you can't be too careful. But when we step back and intellectualize, when we assess the world, and when we do things that evolution didn't prepare us for, like assess historical forces, then it can lead us astray. Results also, in there's a kind of moral seriousness that we often apply to prophets and doomsayers and curmudgeons and pessimists. They sound as if they're serious, that if they're warning us of something. And it's actually very hard to be, I don't want to say an optimist, but even someone who points to real positive developments, actual facts, because it sounds like we're trivializing our predicament. That, as one financial writer put it, pessimists sound like they're trying to help you, optimists sound like they're trying to sell you something.
Yes. Do you think there's a way of changing the way in which we read the world?
I hope so. That, like many cognitive scientists, I hope that an awareness of human cognitive fallacies and biases can become part of our conventional wisdom, and we circumvent them by going to the data whenever possible. So just as we educated people now take for granted things like, you know, say, the placebo effect. If I say, well, I took some herbal supplement and my arthritis went away, a lot of people, even if they're not medical professionals, will say, well, yeah, how do you know it's not a placebo effect? I mean, that's just sort of part of conventionalism of an educated person. That should be more widespread for other kinds of easy fallacies.
Is there any respect, would you say, in which the world, on the long view that you're predicating your argument, isn't getting better?
Well, yes, certainly the threat of nuclear war is particularly the worst-case scenarios in which a nuclear exchange would trigger a nuclear winter would be something that our ancestors didn't have to worry about. And the threat of human-made climate change as a result of carbon emissions is another measure that has not been getting better. I see these as problems to be solved, not as apocalypses in waiting, but they aren't areas in which you can point to a lot of recent progress.
Matt Ridley has written a book which has a similar argument in some respects to yours, The Rational Optimist.
Yes.
You know, he's declaredly optimistic. Are you the same?
I love Matt Ridley's book, and Matt and I actually were on the same side as in a formal debate on the world's best days are ahead of them. So I suppose I'm committed to being an optimist in that sense. Although I prefer the term from the late Swedish doctor Hans Rosling, who said, I don't consider myself an optimist, I consider myself a very serious possibilist.
Possibilist, good. Can I just ask also, I mean, you write in the book, I think about a quarter of the way through, you say, all my friends who... So I was writing this book, said, you've got to make it all about how Donald Trump's going to mess everything up.
Yes.
I mean, does he and, you know, the rise of what he represents in America provide a sort of fly in the ointment to your worldview, or is it a kind of blip in the graph and an outlier, do you think?
It's too soon to say. It would be all too easy for me to say it's a blip. And in fact, some of my readers said, don't mention him at all. The book is going to outlast his presidency. He's a footnote. He'll be forgotten. I guess I'm not that optimistic. So I do deal with Trump, and many of his policies unquestionably push back against exactly the forces that I have celebrated in the book. Pollution has gone down in industrialized countries, and thanks to environmental regulations that he wants to roll back. Wars between nations have gone down thanks to international norms and institutions that he wants to dismantle. Even increased longevity has been helped by the vaccines, which he tried to undermine, and availability of medical care, which he's tried to push back. So I have a list in which a number of the forces that I champion are indeed under threat. And the question is, how much will the system push back? Stepping back and putting him into a larger context, I see him as part of a recurring set of counter-Enlightenment movements that have pushed back against the Enlightenment since it originated. Forces of nationalism, of authoritarianism, of tribalism, sometimes of outright racism, of magical thinking, that have their roots in human nature. The institutions of the Enlightenment try to put a lid on them, but they're constantly under threat by counter-Enlightenment forces, and Trump is just the latest.
That was Steven Pinker and Sam Leith. And tune into the latest Spectator Books podcast for a full conversation between Steven and Sam. And finally, whether it's stones sliding across the ice, skiers slaloming down the slopes, or body parts making unexpected appearances during the figure skating, the world has had its eyes on the Korean district of Pyeongchang, where the 23rd Winter Olympics are being held. But why can't we as a nation fall in love with snow sports? Roger Alton looks at this in the magazine, and he joins me now. So, Roger, are you absolutely riveted by the Winter Olympics?
Well, I mean, weirdly, I'm the only person I know, I'm probably the only person in the country who's interested in more or less all the time, and I found myself listening to an ice hockey commentary on radio, which is just about the most impenetrable thing you can have, and then watching mixed doubles curling, and that's quite heavy going, but it just shows you wasted your life. I like skiing, basically. I like snow sports. But then you can watch all this other stuff, and it's very thrilling. And these guys risk their lives, a lot of the snow sports guys and girls. It's sort of gymnastic in midair at the height of a three-story building where there is no safety net. You make a mistake and you can really damage yourself. And the British team here has been badly injured all over the shop.
It really does make the Summer Olympics look pretty tame by comparison. I think the pole vault is the thing that makes people most nervous. But why is there such a comparative lack of interest?
Partly this time, I think the time gap isn't a help. It's all on throughout the night.
But people stay up to listen to the Ashes, don't they?
Some people. I stayed up to listen to the Ashes on BT Sport, and I felt I could probably have had everybody else in the country round to my house for the last test. It really did tail off, and it wasn't a huge success for BT Sport, which is a great pity, I think. I'm not sure. You can find me somebody stayed up to watch the women's downhill all the way through last night, for example. I watched Lindsay Vonn, and then eventually went to bed, and that was quite late, well past 2 a.m. So there's the problem for Britain. We've done incredibly badly, relatively speaking, this time.
But we are mad about a lot of sports in which we regularly do badly. Our national game, for instance.
Football.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are about to have possibly 5 teams in the quarterfinals of the elite club tournament of all time. So, I think that's not quite as simple as that. We've got the best league in the world of football. But we've done relatively badly. It could change a bit. We've got a medal in curling, whether it's sort of gold, silver or bronze, we don't know yet. And we might conceivably have a slalom medal with Dave the Rocket riding, who's a boy from Yorkshire who might do well in the slalom. Fingers crossed, that's Thursday morning.
We've got some medal prospects. We've got danger. Yeah. We've got glamour. Yeah. The odd body part popping out has happened in the figure skating with one of the French skaters. Yeah. So what's wrong? I mean, I have to admit, I love the figure skating, love the skeleton luge.
Yeah.
But
you really love the skeleton. Well, it's quite difficult to know what's going on.
It does get
We are brilliant at the skeleton, and we pick up endless gold medals, and gold and bronze.
I love it because I find it compelling that someone would want to shoot down a hill on a tea tray head first. Mm. That's weird, and I can't quite get over that. Mm. But it is a bit repetitive. And I wonder whether this is the case for quite a number of these disciplines.
It's the same thing.
Cross-country skiing, for instance. Yeah. You don't see them racing against one another.
Yeah.
You see them racing against the clock, and, he's cut a tenth off his time, and he's punching the air. Yeah. And, we understand these tiny gains that athletes make because we watch 100 metres, for instance, in the summer athletics. But there's something about not seeing people cross the finish line together.
Yeah. There's
a bit boring, do you think?
In cross-country skiing, you do. You cross the finishing line together. You set off at race and you do in the biathlon. It's a sort of competition. That's where they had the Frenchman and the German had a sort of literally dead heat, but the Frenchman got his ski over the last one and they collapsed on the ground. It was really quite thrilling. If you're interested in biathlon, which I'm sure you're not, you've got to be quite
I clearly got put off early on in that case.
But the downhill, I think, is sort of referring to the alpine skiing where, of course, you set off at different times. But the thrill's there. I mean, there's the danger. I mean, these are men and women, you had the women's this morning, racing at speeds of 80, 90 miles an hour. It's extraordinary risk to themselves and often, really, really seriously, major injury. And so although they might be finishing at a different time, if you look and if you like seeing a tiny bit, you do know, you can see when somebody's really putting it out there, really stretching, even though the differences between the times are marginal. So it's very exciting. But we're not an alpine country, so we don't have great downhill. We've hardly had any downhill skiers picking up, even World Cup places, we had a couple. certainly not in the Olympics that we might have with riding, fingers crossed. We just haven't got enough personal involvement in it in alpine skiing, but in the sort of ballet skiing, you know, this freestyle stuff and the snowboard and the whatever, we've got a huge sort of contingent of really fabulous kids, and they're very attractive. I think they're very good looking. I mean, they're really good looking.
Tell me about some of these good looking well, look at
James Woods,
and women.
You know, James Woodsy Woods, he's a fabulously attractive guy, looks like he's never been near a hairbrush, charming. The girls are fantastic. There's a lovely guy, a girl called Rowan Cheshire, highly tattooed, beautiful, radiant smile, who came seventh, which is not bad for us. And then you've got the actual winners. So you had a wonderful Coloradan 17-year-old called Red Gerard, and he won gold, and he'd been up all night binging on Netflix, so he nearly missed the start, but just managed there, which is quite a snowboardy thing to do. And he's got long hair, and he's utterly charming. And a girl called Chloe Kim, who's American-Korean, who won the girls snowboarding. Just wonderful, a wonderful story. Her father was Korean, came over to America, and through hard work, set her up as a champion. She's an Olympic champion at 17. The two Olympic champions of snowboard, men and women, they can't buy a drink. They're not old enough to buy a drink. These are fantastic stories. And they're lovely. They're fabulous, and they're charming and funny. You know?
And one of the similarities between the summer and winter athletes is that they all seem to see the vitriol they receive on Twitter when they don't do well, which I find extraordinary that a leading sports person would even care about Twitter, but it shows how sort of powerful it is. But you often see them answering their critics.
Is that right?
Within you're an hour of not getting the medal.
Is that right? Okay. So they get a lot of it. So at least Christie, we might be referring to here, is the speed skater, who was the sort of British golden hope, who in Sochi, she was disqualified in all her three races. And here in Korea has been either disqualified or crashed out of all her three races. So she had six Olympic races, six failures. And so I imagine she's got a little bit of heat on Twitter. I don't know, but I assume so.
It's an interesting element of sports psychology, I think, now that you must have to talk about social media as you're preparing for these events. Even though there is less interest in this country in the Winter Olympics, we are still spending quite a lot of money on them, aren't we?
A lot of money. Then part of the sort of story of this, I think, is the question that it raises about funding. So broadly, our policy on funding is to find out sports where you know you can get gains through a certain amount of money. You can get gains. Just sort of shoving a lot of money at sprinting, not much point in that because everybody around the world sprints. Shove a lot of money at, say, cycling, and there's a chance of a good return because not that many people do a lot of cycling. So we've ploughed millions into cycling, and the rewards are fantastic. We've had huge Olympic rewards. The amount of money spent on cycling is cycling alone is fractionally under the amount of money we spend on all winter sports. So whether it's sort of, you know, bobsleigh, skeleton, skating, skiing, so on, it's all of it.
Do you think that's justified?
Well, on sheer sort of, you know, balance and loss, you know, profit and loss, you'd have to say it probably is, because we are aiming at five medals. We've got four already. We're going to pick up one through curling and conceivably might pick up another. It's a target, but it's not that we know. We were hoping 5 to 10. Minimum five. Terrific to get any more. We will get five, but it hasn't been a great game. So I think the chances of the money going up seem fairly remote. And then you get down this argument, should you be spending a lot of money on alpine skiing, which is basically done by sort of quite well-off people, or should you be spending it on basketball, which is done by millions and millions of people, and hardly gets any money at all.
Thanks, Roger. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, where this week Damien Thompson is discussing anti-Semitism at London universities. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Max Pemberton, Rian Mallon and Roger Kimball. We have a special offer for podcast listeners. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12, and we'll throw in a coveted red Spectator notebook. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.